Yep. Give me a nod when you're ready. Jitter's ready. Stand by.
Hey everyone, welcome to this episode of Bullets and Bourbon. Today I'm not joined by my co-host, it's just going to be me today, Frank Gao. Matt is currently on a work trip down in Florida, so he's not going to be here for this episode. But our special guest today is Kevin Chen from Apollo Arms. Apollo recently hit the scene as a high-tier manufacturer for open guns, limited optics guns, basically the 2011 system. And Kevin, I've run into you several times before. I've run into you at Sir Walter and some of these local matches up here in the Virginia area. Real quick, so I've been talking back and forth with Kevin for a while. He built a 2011, an open gun for Sam Nelson, who shot it and it ran really well down there at IPSC Nationals a couple weeks ago. But I also had a chance to talk to your mother a little bit, and she kind of filled me in on some of your background. And just real quick, just tell me if I get anything wrong. You raised in New York, did your undergrad at Berkeley, and then you did your master's in Cambridge, about to go get your PhD. Some stuff came up, so you ended up getting your Juris Doctorate in North Carolina. You practiced as a lawyer for a bit, and then you got into the 2011 manufacturing business. Is that all correct?
Yep.
Okay. So
condensed version. There's some other stuff, but.
Yeah. And we can definitely get into it. But looking at that resume, I wouldn't expect someone of, you know, that academic background to end up becoming a 2011 manufacturer. So when did that first start interesting you? And when did you finally make the jump from lawyer to manufacturer?
Yeah, so my path, I think, to a lot of people would have seemed, untargeted or unfocused, but in my mind, I'd always wanted to do something technical. So my academic background is heavily based in the legal discipline, its applications and governance and whatnot. But I also was always interested in how it connected with technology and with the manufacturing processes. So when I did my undergrad at Berkeley, obviously being in close proximity to the Silicon Valley, it was a great opportunity to be able to engage with the tech community and see how they ran businesses, how they approached problem solving, and how they streamline a lot of processes that would bog down large companies. So with that in mind, I, you know, always try to do something technically related, even though my academic career was never truly focused on hard applied sciences. To me, actually, the transition was rather seamless because beyond school, I have a lot of different interests. I play a lot of music. I do a lot of art. And while like the creative side seems completely irrelevant to science and machining, there's a lot of intersection between the two disciplines. So, the design aspect of it is obviously very relevant, but being able to use a wide variety of tools, understanding how to apply the use of those tools in various scenarios was really important conceptually in creating a structure in my mind to be able to take in a lot of information in a very short amount of time. So one thing that led to this is I did a lot of woodworking, a lot of hand tool woodworking. That taught me how to sharpen blades.
Okay.
Very, very sharply. You know, using specialized whetstones. And because of that, you know, anyone who's familiar with fine tool, hand tool woodworking, knows that a lot of tools that we use, we make ourselves, like the blades, oftentimes are not available. So these are all like 18th century, 19th century tools. And that taught me how to grind, steel. And it definitely is very much, as much of a science, it definitely is art as well. So there's a lot of application of like hand dexterity and being able to work with your hands very well. That is all sitting in the background of my academic career. When I came back from England, I was already doing something relevant. I was a part of a large research team doing randomized controlled trials, studying the effects of the application and use of tasers and body worn cameras. Mm-hmm. So that already exposed me quite a bit to some of the methodological and scientific tools to analyze data, right? So, and also, you know, obviously the use of, when coming back from England, rewind a little bit. Mm-hmm. At Cambridge, I shot on the University of Cambridge's rifle team, and I shot small bore and full bore there. And that was actually my first introduction to competitive shooting. I'd always plinked around and always enjoyed it, but never had an opportunity to like formalize the process of training and competing. So shooting on that team was exceptional, just being surrounded by, some of them are shooting on the national team, which their world shoot is happening in South Africa as well. I definitely was engaged in the shooting discipline just in the rifle arena. And when coming back, I had started developing some of my own prototype components, grip modules, cheek rest for my rifle. At the time, I still have this rifle. I'm shooting a Walther KK300, phenomenal small bore rifle. And I have a full bore action, a 308 that's made for it, and shoot Palma rifle with that as well. And that discipline is a 1,000 yards iron sights with a sling and jacket. Mm. But that was my introduction into the gun manufacturing. And it wasn't until 2021 that I started shooting pistols. The first time I actually ever shot a pistol, and the rest is history.
Yeah. So was that the point at which you discovered USPSA?
The first time I ever shot a pistol was the afternoon before my first USPSA match. I shot 5 rounds through a STI DVC open and then went to the match shooting back in major power factor, which was not fun.
Yeah. What was your first match? Where was that at?
This was at BNR. It's a real small match.
Yeah. So I actually know where that is. Yeah. We used to go to that match because that's really close to Camp Lejeune. Right. So when I first got there, I looked up matches and I was like, oh, BNR. And I showed up and I was just like, I got to go find something else. And that's how I ended up going to Sir. That's how I ended up going to Sir Walter, which I've run into. I've run into you at Sir Walter several times. That's really interesting. Real quick. You strike me as the kind of person who gets into a lot of different. So you've mentioned music. You've mentioned woodworking. You mentioned that you used to shoot what I'm assuming is a version of like high power bullseye rifle.
Yeah.
You still maintain any of those hobbies, or are you all wholly dedicated to what you're doing right now?
I'll say, I think they're all interlinked. I constantly think about all these different things and doing one very focused job, but I mean, I would love to get back into shooting rifle. I'd love to start shooting PRS because that was the direction I was trying to go towards. I also have ambitions to manufacture a lot of very unique full bore long range rifle systems. But no, I don't have time to do any of that anymore. Unfortunately,
I don't imagine you do.
I wish I definitely wish I had more time to train USPSA.
Yeah, for sure.
You know, at the very minimum, like just dry firing, but that's something I'm working on.
Yeah, absolutely. So would you say that it's the process that appeals to you with all these hobbies? I mean, all of these hobbies are meticulous in nature. They require a lot of attention. I mean, it seems like you've started over again and again, whether it be getting into 2011 manufacturing or learning a new instrument. Is that part, that engagement with whatever technical hobby that you happen to be solely focused on, is that what keeps pulling you in?
Yeah. I love going down rabbit holes and problem solving, and building guns was to me the intersection of all the different things that I loved about the other hobbies and interests. This very much became an addiction and an obsession to figure out, one, how to make the gun fully reliable in all situations all the time. You know, I started out with guns that broke down constantly.
Yeah.
And when you really start investigating, the math, the physics behind every part and how they come together as a system, you realize, wow, like there's a lot of knowledge you have to have from other, that you might have gained from other disciplines that becomes extremely useful. Like all the skills that I developed throughout my education, other, you know, interests I use every day.
Yeah. So I'd have to imagine that one, the level of focus and also the attention to detail required to practice law has definitely translated into your work as a manufacturer. Would you find that accurate?
Yeah. The ability to think critically, to really assess the validity of facts, to really isolate those facts and to analyze it and synthesize some sort of result from it, I think has been really important. It actually is very analogous, the way you approach problems and solve those problems, whether it's in the legal discipline or in manufacturing. So yeah, every day is a new day here. And even when you make very big leaps in innovation, you know, always learning. And that's the beauty of it, is like the continuous learning and also the failures. Like you learn a lot from making mistakes. You learn a lot from, you know, I think you learn more from that than your successes in many ways.
Yeah. So, yeah. When you're working with open guns, you're definitely going to run into quite a few failures. I'd like to talk a little bit about the support system behind Apollo Arms. And we'll start off with Chris Tilley. So at what point did you get introduced to Chris? And then how has that influenced? I mean, you obviously have the technical backgrounds and the mental acumen to understand these guns. But I'd have to imagine that talking to someone who's been a world champion, been a national champion several times, helped influence the actual design philosophy and some of the mechanisms behind these guns. Is that accurate?
Yeah. So Chris, I met him actually in, I believe it was the fourth match I'd ever shot. So, and it was actually a very surreal experience for me, at least, because I'd always watch USPSA videos when I was a kid. And growing up in New York, I never had the opportunity to shoot any pistols, at least easily. But I'd always watch, you know, the Super Squad shooters at the Open Nats and IPSC. And it was awesome to get to meet Chris in person. But very quickly it dawned on me that, man, Chris is one of the most approachable, like superstars, and he was really willing to engage very quickly into very technical conversations, both about the gun and how to shoot. And at the time, obviously, I was a very, I still am a very new pistol shooter. And there was a lot of things that I could see he was trying to get at, and I didn't have the experience to be able to comprehend it. Fast forward a bit. So, right before, this year's Open Nationals, Chris came on and that's where we really start. You know, I had gained a lot of knowledge about the double stack platform, the 1911 platform at that point. I had built several prototypes and seen what worked and what didn't. And when, you know, Chris had shot one of my prototypes and really was astounded by how well it tracked. And, you know, at that point, I had started understanding why a lot of nine major, especially nine major open guns cracked, and also why guns would start tracking in different, you know, axis directions. Mm-hmm. So yeah, Chris is phenomenal. He's a true professor of the craft, from a shooting standpoint and a user, you know, firearms user standpoint. He's, very technically inclined, and he really investigates every nuanced detail of how to shoot and what the gun should be like. So that's, you know, that's evident in his own career and the companies he's worked with. And this was a real phenomenal opportunity to be able to develop something very innovative. A lot of the design, a lot of the ideas I have is rather unorthodox. Mm-hmm. And it just marries really well with Chris's approach to, shooting and how the gun should perform.
Yeah. Your primary, I guess, experience learning the double stack 2011 platform, was Chris a huge part of that, or were you mostly self-studied through other means?
I'm almost up until Open Nationals, this year's Open Nationals, I was entirely self-taught. I had very little guidance, but I also am of the opinion that guidance, obviously, like good coaching, good education in any discipline is really beneficial to improving quickly. But I had enough technical knowledge to be able to see the mechanisms that were at play, and like looking at dimensions. So I ended up buying a lot of open guns and seeing, you know, just with the goal of having something that would run. Mm-hmm. And none of them did. Mm-hmm. Every single one had some sort of, reliability issue, or they would just shoot terribly, you know, performance wise. So those guns actually taught me a lot about what not to do.
Going on about that, that makes sense. I think if as an open shooter, if you are dedicated, you one end up owning a lot of them because yeah. A lot of them are unreliable, and you kind of become a de facto gunsmith simply because
yes,
you're taking
absolutely.
Them apart. Like the meme of shooter at the safe table is so prevalent. Like every time I walk up and there's already an open shooter there, I'm like,
yeah, like, which is unfortunate.
Come here often. Yeah,
I'll say so. One reason that might be is for that stereotype was very valid. Is you know, it is open division. We are at the extreme of potential performance, and oftentimes sacrificing reliability. But I'm of the opinion that the 1911 double stack 2011 platform can be as reliable or unreliable as any other gun.
Yes.
The thing is, most manufacturers of double stack 1911 type guns are focused on maximizing performance, optimizing for performance at the sake of reliability. And certainly there are manufacturers that don't, you know, have different product lines that focus on or like more combat or tactically oriented, that focus more on reliability. I do think that any gun can be made to be exceptionally reliable, and at the same time be be optimized for the balance of performance and reliability.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah,
I want to talk. Yeah, I want to talk about some of the other support systems that you have. So when we're down there at I'll just paint the scene for everybody. We're down there at IPSC Nationals, waiting for the scores to get tabulated. You have a bunch of dudes crowded around a random safe table, looking at the gun that you built for Sam Nelson, and they're geeking out over it. And you're explaining things, and you know, like Bill Drummond's, Aaron Eddins, like all these people are just flocking to this gun. I was actually, you know, standing about 30 feet away chatting with your mom during that time. And I was like, you must be really proud of them. Like, you know, they're all here to see his gun, and it looks like he's converting a lot of customers. But she seems to make a lot of trips with you. And we, you know, we talked honestly, a lot of, she said this herself, a lot of Asian parents don't necessarily roll as well with some of these career changes. I know when I told my parents I want to join the Marines, they're like, why? Like, why are you doing that? Because, you know, the career path that they saw for me was so much different. So how has that support kind of played into some of your early successes and the continued operation of your company?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely would not be here without my mom. She's absolutely amazing. She's my best friend, and she's been 100% supportive of everything from the rip. It was pretty clear to her that this was what I loved doing, and that I was just obsessed about this. And to me, coming in every day, it's not like work. It isn't work. It's a lot of hard, you know, it's very challenging. It's very hard, a lot of, you know, very long hours, but, very worthwhile and rewarding. And she saw that, you know, when I was just doing this for fun. So, yeah, she's, you know, she's gone on countless, like the majority of the matches I've ever shot, she's been with me. All the majors, she's been with me. So she's absolutely awesome. And it's, you know, it's funny. I actually, you know, we see that quite a bit throughout the USPSA and IPSC communities, which is awesome. Like the family is hugely important, and you see that reflected through countless people. So yeah, no, it's always amazing to have that family support, and super lucky to have that, and very grateful for that.
Yeah, I bet. And it was cool to share that moment with her. I mean, she was clearly proud of what you'd achieved, and all these people who, you know, were flocking to the safe table just to get hands on one of your open guns. Want to talk a little bit about your entry into USPSA. So, I mean, competitive shooting has some interesting personalities, especially in the open division. We talked about frequent visits to the safe table, but there are some other, I guess, traps that open shooters tend to fall into. What were some things that you initially thought of when you got into competitive shooting in USPSA? And then how have some of those things changed over time?
Yeah. You know, I was coming from the rifle shooting community, and in many ways, it was generally very similar, very technically inclined people, people who really want to discover themselves and push themselves. So in that respect, it was a seamless transition. It was very clear to me that I wanted to be shooting USPSA as much as possible. I loved everything about it. I started out in open, and I have predominantly only shot open, and I think it was a terrible idea. but anyway, that's a different conversation. But yeah, the open division is definitely has a lot of interesting personalities. You know, you're, again, this is the F1 of our sports, and you have everyone trying to perform at peak abilities as a shooter, trying to push the guns to their limits so that generally invites very, you know, interesting people in. And at the same time, some of the most welcoming people I've met have been in the open division. And, you know, a lot of the guys that you mentioned, you know, they're phenomenal people. They're really welcoming of new shooters, and just their reputation is well deserved, not only as shooters but as ambassadors of the sport. Mm-hmm. So that's really important for the sport, for sure.
Yeah, that's awesome that you met people that were as welcoming as they were, that really, you know, pushed you further into this, to the point where you are now manufacturing these guns. Let's talk about the gun. So you intended to put out a high-end 2011 meant to turn heads in the competitive market.
Yeah.
And you already talked about the blend between performance and reliability. But from top to bottom, talk us through the manufacturing process, where you are now, and then perhaps you can tell us a little bit about where you want to be in terms of self-sufficiency, because I know you are still at the point where you are sourcing certain parts.
So my facility is based an hour south of Richmond. It's a 4,000 square foot facility, and I've actually just completed the three-phase installation for the machinery that will be coming. The machines that you see here are plugged into that power system now. To start with the machinery, so I have very sophisticated fifth axis as well as fourth axis machining centers coming in here pretty soon, and that will give me the ability to manufacture every component of my pistol in-house, including heat treatment as well. So that's really critical, given what I'm after. There's really no aspect of the gun, no radius, no curve on the gun that I haven't considered. And effectively everything that's out there right now, I have to shape to, the dimensions that I'm after. So it'll be a blessing to have everything made in-house, and to be able to achieve a very exceptional level of dimensional consistency. I have a lot of thoughts about various geometries throughout both the reciprocation of the gun and where the critical locking and clearance portions of the gun need to be, as well as the locations of all the critical holes for the ignition system, as well as the components themselves. But that obviously affects how clean the trigger is, how light the trigger can be. So I like to be able to achieve a half pound trigger and to bring it up to the desired weight of the customer. But to be able to achieve that weight, there's quite a bit of math and geometry involved.
Yeah, and real quick, that's one of the things that you talked to us about when we took a look at your gun down at Open Nationals. And it sounded like that was a very involved process. Can you walk us through what it takes for you to do a trigger job?
Yeah, it can take sometimes up to 8 hours. So, but it's also an evolving process that I continually refine. So I have right now my own fixture that I designed and machined, and I stone everything up to oftentimes up to 30,000 grit with specialized whetstones that I've sourced from Japan and France. And it takes a lot of finesse and a lot of measuring under a mic. So I also do it under a microscope.
Oh, wow.
That gives me the most precise interpretation of all the angles, and to be able to see the how parallel that those surfaces are, and how well they're engaging with the hammer. I'm talking about the steer right
Yeah.
now.
Okay. Yeah. Super cool,
And
man.
there's also a lot of other aspects to it, a lot of tuning and deburring, polishing that you have to do throughout the rest of the frame, the grip module to an extent, and the when your trigger bow is. So it can get really complicated actually once you start involving all these other components. You have to see how everything works together, not only individually.
Okay. So we talked a bit about your learning phase, buying open guns, kind of like learning the system, being self-taught. You said that your trigger job takes 8 hours. How long did your first one take? Like the first one that you approached from that level of detail and level of life.
Truthfully, I think that first gun, that first prototype gun, it was an evolution of tuning the trigger over a course of maybe like 6-7 months. So, a lot of sears being thrown out, but so my approach was I wanted to understand what definitely would not work because that would indicate the polar direction. And once you start understanding, once you start approaching what does work, you start really going into the nuance of why it happens. So, my approach to a lot of things is always asking, one, the purpose of that particular item, the function of that particular piece. And then investigating, all its parameters and how it works.
Yeah, that's geez, I do not have the patience that you have. I'll say that for sure. In terms of like raw materials, what are you using for all the parts on the gun?
So a lot of carbon steel. The grips are 17-4 stainless. Mag wells can be a medley of materials from brass to just general carbon steel or stainless steel, aluminum, and my comps are grade 5 titanium, optics mounts are 70-75 aluminum, as are the thumb rests. Yeah, and so I do have something in the works right now that will, in terms of materials and material science, will be quite innovative, and that will appear in many critical components of an open gun and have great application in a limited optics gun, and then other variations of it that have, potential tactical or combat applications. So those particular items will be very interesting in minimizing the vibrations you see in the dots, and it'll give a lot cleaner visual tracking of the dot of the gun and give you a more honest feedback of what the gun is doing in your hand.
Yeah, and that's purely based on material composition. Is this metallurgy or just like basically creating your own alloy? I don't know if I'm using that correctly.
Yeah. No, I'm not reinventing the wheel in that way.
Okay.
there, certain materials have shock absorbing properties, vibration dampening characteristics that can play a huge part in important components of an open gun, as well as a limited optics gun.
Okay.
It was just a number of things that I saw, especially in developing the limited optics gun, with actually the dot potentially failing in the gun itself. So, using an entirely steel gun induces quite a bit of shock to the dot that's mounted on the slide. So I already developed like various components to mitigate all that, and it has. I have a very proven item that has basically taken that away, but there's going to be another big advancement after that.
Very cool. Let's talk about the compensator, right? So you sent me some pictures of your comp, and you know, you've developed your very own design there. I know you're building guns for people, and then you're also developing parts for the guns that you're going to be building in the future. I guess how is that time split? And then what's the process, and like how do you decide what part of the gun you want to focus on? And then if you don't mind, I know you're gonna submit for a patent for it, but for the compensator, what were some of the steps to developing that particular component?
Yeah, so I have to structure my day very carefully. So again, very long hours. I come in 5 o'clock, and I'm usually here until at least midnight normally. I have to split my time up between the R&D phase and the production phase. The production guns are tried and true designs that have what I feel is sufficient testing time, not only in theoretical terms, but in the fields. And those are very polished products that are going to go into a customer's hand. And then the R&D side, I feel, is very critical. My perspective is, if I have, well, I will never stop R&D. I even in, 30, 40 years time, I will still be trying to push the limits and developing some refinements of an existing system or something new. Chris, Tilly's wonderful in that respect, because he's incredibly open-minded to all sorts of really neat ideas and things that others have not tried. Bill Drummond's also another person who has that character and has thought of some really neat and valid ideas that will be put to test pretty soon. That's kind of the division between that approach. In terms of the comp, one of the things I had to do, given that I was self-taught, was having to trace the history of the 1911 platform. I talk with Eddie Garcia quite a bit, and he's big on studying the blueprint of the gun, and spent a lot of time looking at the blueprints and really analyzing that. You start understanding how things work and how things interplay, but then also looking at the work of past gun manufacturers, small builders. So people like Jim Boland, he's a really innovative builder. He is someone that if you were alive today, those guns are truly space guns. They're very, very alien-like. But the concepts behind his guns were very familiar to what we're after. He was trying to solve problems that we today still are trying to tackle in any gun platform and for any division or application. But looking at the comps, the design of any comp has been pretty stagnant, in my opinion. And the whole rationale is just expelling gas. And you have different iterations of how to expel it to maximize the amount of gas coming out. The problem is it induces quite a bit of, extreme amount of vibrations and shock once the gas is expelling, and it creates a very violent recoil impulse. And there's ways to mitigate that throughout the gun. One modern trend has been to increase the weight of the gun entirely whether it's a longer or wider dust cover, to dampen, you know, the shock of and recoil of a major open major gun. How I approached it was I was after not only the maximum amount of gas that would expel, but the rate with which it was coming out of the comp and gun. Mm-hmm. I wanted to prolong the gas as much as possible throughout the entire reciprocation of the gun. And what that would theoretically, and now we're already seeing that it's proven to be empirically valid, that the gun tracks much more consistently. It creates a much softer feeling gun without jeopardizing much of how flat it can be. And that balance, it's always a trade-off between how soft versus how flat the gun can be. And, you know, that balance between the two is a very fine razor's edge.
Okay. When you're talking about the timing of the gas being expelled, is that similar to the technology that's going into certain like suppressors? There's been some suppressors that have like, I guess, redirected gas in certain ways to reduce blowback in other ways. Maybe not quite the same, but it sounds like a similar.
It's a similar concept, not quite the same, but similar physics involved. Yeah.
Okay. Interesting. I know what you mean in terms of the compensator design being rather, I mean, it's just ports on the side and ports on top. So that's really interesting how you got to that point. And I see the creative side coming out. I would have to say that, you know, in the 2011 market, specifically with open guns, there's quite a few manufacturers out there. And I think I said this, you start sending me pictures of some of your builds. I'm like, dude, you have your own design philosophy. Like it has its own aesthetic brand. Speaking of branding, how did the name Apollo Arms come to be?
There's no real good story, I would say. I mean, you know, the space program, the technological innovations and desire to, you know, push what was possible for humans was obviously a big attraction. Go fast. Like, really wasn't much to it.
I wasn't sure if it was, you know, the Greek god or like Apollo and Artemis, or if it was the space program. Have you been to the Air and Space Hangar up there in like Dulles?
No, I haven't.
I mean, it sounds like you're a big fan of that kind of stuff, but dude, I imagine you are, like, space travel, aerospace.
Have to find time.
Dude, I mean, it's not like you, based on what you told me about your schedule, it doesn't sound like you have a lot of time to spare. But that hangar, it has the SR-71 Blackbird just sitting in the open. It has not the Challenger, the Discovery space shuttle. Yeah. Satellites, the Concordia, which is like the supersonic jet that would go across the Atlantic. Yeah, yeah. I think you would have an absolute field day up there, just based on your interests. So yeah, whenever you find the time and your very packed schedule, definitely make it up there and just nerd out all day at the Smithsonian. So you also produce ammo. And I, you know, you and I have talked a lot about tuning ammo to these guns. But is that's, I'm guessing that's going to be a part of the Apollo business that's going to run side by side with the gun manufacturing. What's the setup for ammunition? And I'm guessing it's more or less automated. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. It's automated. Generally as automated as it can be currently with available technologies, but the ammo side of the business is really critical to support the guns. It is very much one system. I'm of the strong opinion that in order to have the most reliable platform, you really have to design the ammunition for the gun and vice versa. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of critical dimensions in the gun that you have to account. You have to kind of make it compatible for certain projectiles, what powder you're going to use, the consistency of your case, how concentric the case is, the case wall thickness, consistency to maximize, you know, the consistent neck tension of the projectile. So there are a lot of concepts that I'd drawn from my rifle reloading days that became really important, in my opinion, of how reliable ammunition was in a particular gun. I believe it's very important, especially in 9mm.
Mm-hmm.
It's gotten to the point where we, you know, Chris really loves how the recoil impulse of the 9 in mm-hmm. my guns, perhaps more so than 30 super comp, but that's, you know, a continued development. Not to say that theoretically the 30 super comp cases has more potential to be better performing than a 9, but yeah, so I've got four Mark 7 Revolutions. It's their direct drive motorized machines, and they're actually phenomenal machines. I initially was in the market for Alpha priming machine and Alpha mm-hmm. loader. And conversely, I was also looking at Camdexes, and when I saw the Revolution and what the priming system could do, it was actually really impressive. It's a real smart design, and the main thing is it's quite. Once it's tuned, it's extremely reliable. So Tom Carlson is awesome. He came. He did some tremendous work to the machines and got them really tuned up, and they just run incredibly. So there's a lot to that can be tinkered with them to make them perform well. But once they are, then I think they're a really hard system to beat.
Yeah, I'm a huge fan of my auto drive, and I agree with you. As soon as you have it tuned right, it's like a copy and paste machine, which also means if you have something wrong, then it's going to create many copies of that wrong piece of ammo.
Yeah.
That's really interesting. So you already talked a little bit about your day-to-day schedule, but you're doing R&D, you're building guns, but you're also, because I talk to you over the phone, you're talking to people over the phone, you're taking orders, and eventually you're going to be, you know, helping out customers who are having issues with their guns. So plans for expansion, additional employees, I'm imagining, is on the horizon?
Yes. Yeah. Right now it's a one-man show, and I've already been interviewing people actually for a number of positions for a programming position. Mm-hmm. And obviously, I'll be hiring quite a bit of staff to do some of the more administrative side of the business, shipping department. But in terms of the building right now, I structured it so that I can fit quite a number of CNC machines in here. So even like as those machines are coming, I already am making plans for the machines after that. And when this floor gets filled, I've got another 2 acres on this parcel that I'll be able to build another building to add to that to be able to ramp up the keep my lead times approximately what it is now, if not less, while maintaining the same level of precision and hand fit tolerances.
Yeah, that'd be really great, because the top tier 2011 manufacturers, you're waiting as long as a year for an Infinity, you know, 6 months for a masterpiece. So delivering within that time span to the level of quality that you built your guns is pretty damn good. So if somebody wants to order a gun from you, they just go on the website, apollousa.com?
You can check out the guns on my website. I am actually So I scrapped that website together pretty quickly, and it truthfully isn't complete. And I'm building a new site, that should be released pretty soon. But best way is just to get a hold of me. I'm on Instagram and Apollo Arms, no space on Instagram. So that's generally the easiest way. But I really love working with every customer, and every gun that leaves my hand is one of my babies. And I build the gun with the perspective that each gun is going to be a lifelong gun for a particular client. So I love developing that relationship with each client, because everyone has different needs. They have different hand sizes and shapes, different anatomies, different ergonomics that are necessary to maximize their ability to shoot the gun at a higher level than a gun that isn't built, bespoke built for them. Mm-hmm. A lot of considerations, as well as like aesthetic considerations into making the gun really connected with a particular personality of a customer. So yeah, I love that process.
Yeah, and it shows. One thing that stands out to me is your willingness to engage with the customer, to provide something that is, I think you mentioned it yourself, you don't want to provide a customer a gun that wouldn't satisfy you as a competitive shooter. And I think it's important that you are a competitive shooter, that you understand that aspect, because, you know, I was joking with Luigi Lee. I think it was Open Nationals. And he was complaining about some 2011 manufacturer. And I was like, well, aren't most of them kind of hard to get along with or hard to get a hold of? Like the customer service, the custom end 2011 manufacturing business is not particularly well known for its customer service. But that's something that you're really good at. And I think that along with the build quality, along with the aesthetics. And I've shot one of your guns. I shot Sam Nelson. So we had a test bay before we shot IPSC Nationals, and it was a really very, very good shooting gun. And it sucks. You know, I think you understand this as an open shooter. Every time you shoot a new gun, you're like, oh man, I like this one too. But I think your build is really something special. I'm happy that someone like Sam Nelson is going to be able to take it to competitions, because he's going to put in the time. Yeah. And I think he's going to do really good things next season. He's already done great things this season with my crappy backup gun. So with the gun you built for him, I think he's going to do even greater things. Guys, check out Apollo Arms. We'll put up their website in the description. They, right now I'm looking at it, they have a Mach 1, which is their open pistol, and they have a limited optics, their Predator build. Also, selling ammunition. There's ordering info, there's a phone number. So please, if you are interested in one of these, reach out to Kevin. If you compete in the Virginia and North Carolina area, you'll probably see him at a match. He travels a lot. He's starting to show up to major matches too. So if you see him, him and Chris Tilley wear very easy to notice bright yellow jerseys. I think that logo is super slick too. It really catches the eye. So go ahead and, you know, introduce yourself, and I'm sure that he'd be happy to let you take a look at some of the builds that he's brought to the match. But at this point, is there anything else that you'd like to leave the listener with?
No, just thank you so much for having me. It's an absolute honor and pleasure. So, very excited for the future and a lot of cool developments coming.
Yeah, I bet, man. As you continue to develop your guns, and we'll definitely want to have you back on, because this is really interesting. Not figuring out how you got into manufacturing, but also hearing like from the business side. I guess your background as a lawyer. This is definitely one of our more unique episodes. If you enjoyed this, we're gonna have this post linked with the Apollo USA. Please go check out their social media pages. If you're Bullets and Bourbon podcast listener, let us know how we're doing. Thanks, guys.